Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, and we are transmitting across the internet. This is episode 97 of Registry Matters. What's going on, Larry? How are you tonight?
Oh, we're just having a fantastic week at the Balloon Fiesta.
Oh, tell me about that real quick. How close are you? Do they fly over your house?
Occasionally do, depending on how which way the upper level currents take them in the box, as it's called. The wind blows, and the Albuquerque box is world famous. So you can come back to where you launched if you fly your balloon at the right altitude. But yeah, sometimes they get very close, but it's more on the north side of the city than I'm on the south side, so they really don't come that close to me. But I can see them off in the horizon.
Did you go out and check them out? I'm just personally like I would love to go check out that balloon festival. They're just like, it's every camera buff's dream to go out there because of all the dynamic colors, all the super bright colors of all the balloons, and the crazy designs that they end up with, like a bottle of Jack Daniels and stuff like that.
The special shapes, and it's an amazing event. And for those of you who have never heard of it, it started in 1972. So this is the 48th one, and I've not been here for all of them. I've been here for about 36 of them. And they were in their infancy. They were an adolescent, I guess, when I came to New Mexico. But they started. It was a 50th anniversary celebration for KOB Radio. The equivalent of your Atlanta's WSB, 50,000 watt. And they decided to have some of the DJs, they still played music in those days, and they decided that they were going to celebrate the station's 50th birthday by having some hot air balloons launched from Coronado Center, which is a shopping mall that's actually still in business and doing fairly well. And they launched 13 balloons from Coronado. And then it was such a success with the people and the spectators that they've grown. And it's now, it just draws hundreds of thousands of spectators. And they have 500 or 600 balloon pilots enter each year. And it's an amazing event. It's a big economic event for the city.
That's awesome. I think that would be fantastic to go see. At least once, if not more often than once. Have you ever been in one?
I have worked in there. I've attended, and I've never flown the balloon, but I've been out there very close. I think we're the only major fiesta that actually allows people, the balloons, the spectators are allowed on the launch field.
Okay.
So you don't have to sit in the spectators arena, which is the way they in earlier years before they went to the current site they're at, they had them in the grandstands, but you actually can walk around the field, interact with the pilots, watch them launch the balloons. I mean, it's just amazing experience to be at the festival. And it's gotten kind of expensive now because everything does when it becomes popular. So it costs $15 to park your car there. Well, I remember when it was like $3. So, and of course, Brenda listening in, where they pay $15 and don't think anything about parking in Maryland, that's an astronomical parking fee for us here. You park here at the airport for anywhere from $3.99 to like $7 a day at the offsite, and you might pay $10, $11 a day on the airport. So it's like parking is plentiful here, and it's not expensive like it is in some eastern cities. But she's sitting there saying, well, $15, that doesn't sound that bad to me.
Right. Well, let's dive right in. We have some very interesting, upsetting, and outstanding content. Let us start with some of the breaking news. So this is where Galen Bachman was found to be not safe for society and indefinitely locked up?
Well, he hasn't been. He has been found. The jury has returned the verdict. I think it was Thursday afternoon or Friday. We can get Brenda in here later. We want to dive into this, but the jury returned the verdict that he is a sexually violent predator. And then I guess under Virginia law, the judge has an option to commit them to the Virginia Behavioral Rehabilitation Center or put them in the community with stringent controls and treatment requirements. And I'm banking on the first option because they've spent so much money And I just can't see them saying, "Oh, well, we can just release him to community. The community is where he was when he made the inappropriate contact with the teenagers." So I just don't see that happening. But it certainly is a possibility. So it's sad. We're looking at a certain appeal, and NARSL has communicated to the people there that the issue of civil commitment in this circumstance where the person had previously been their commitment had been sought previously and been denied, the jury had found him he was not eligible for commitment without a new sex offense, this is the second bite of the apple. So that's the appellate issue. It's whether you like Galen or whether you dislike Galen. One tries to disconnect from their like or dislike and say this is wrong. He didn't commit any sexual offenses. He didn't even break the law. He broke his probation, but texting a 16-year-old is not against the law.
And you said that they will appeal?
Well, the Galen will.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What would you just hypothesize? I mean, what would you suspect if you could just throw out, you know, look at your crystal ball? Do you think that he would win, or do you think that it would come down the same again?
The crispest, sharpest issue is the second bite at the apple. Clearly, if you try to challenge civil commitment in and of itself, you're going to lose because the courts have resoundingly said that it's okay to civilly commit people. So if they take the tack that they want to attack civil commitment in and of itself, they'll lose that hands down. But if they focus on the laser issue here, which is whether or not you can continually seek commitment for a person who you've already had your chance and you failed, that I think there's some possible traction there. He's probably not the most attractive vehicle to ride because they really poured it on in terms of what they put on. And evidence, they had a two-week trial practically, and they flew people in from all over the country, you know, that are now adults, and they made him look really horrible. Hmm. But you know, we don't get the choice of people don't understand that. This is the case. There will be an appeal. We've got two choices. We can sit back and say, gee, we don't like Galen, and I'm not saying that I don't like Galen, but we as the people who are out there who found this issue important, we could say, well, we'd rather have a better vehicle. Well, he's going to appeal, and there's going to be appellate case law. So what do you do? You try to support the appeal to get the outcome you're looking for, which is you don't get a second bite at the apple.
Yeah. And then do you have an update on the Georgia Halloween putting signs in people's yards?
We do have an update for that. Both lawsuits, we ended up having two lawsuits filed. We had targeted two counties in Georgia, and those were Butts and Spalding, and we decided to file in both counties, and the court that was assigned the case for Spalding County, which is the northern district of Georgia, that federal court has already granted the request for a hearing on the request for injunctive relief, saying that they can't do that. So there's going to be a hearing, and at the moment the date is escaping me, but it's in late October there's going to be a hearing on the request for an injunction. And of course I'm very hopeful that the injunction is granted, but both lawsuits have been filed, the parties have been served, and these machinations are underway.
And remind me again, injunction, I think you say it's a very high bar to achieve an injunction?
It is an extremely, extremely high bar to get an injunction. When you get an injunction, you're getting relief that you have not won in your case. And so therefore, to ask the court to prejudge your case and give you relief you haven't won, that's an extremely high order. You have to show that you will likely succeed when the case finally does go to trial. And you have to show irreparable harm, and there's two other lesser important components that you have to show, but those are the biggies. And the irreparable harm is so hard because you can't speculate.
Right.
Okay. I mean, we had a guy that came to a Georgia meeting that said, "Well, you know, these sheriffs are going to retaliate. They may in fact do that, But we can't ask the court to give an injunction because the sheriffs may retaliate. We have to wait until they do. And the same thing, these projectiles may come through these people's windows. But until we have someone saying, I'm going to launch a projectile to any through any sex offender's window that has this sign, it's mere speculation. Bad things may happen, but they may not, right?
Yes, yes, yes. And did anybody ever come forward saying that they did put the sign up and their house got trashed, harassed, anything? Do we have like an actual somebody being harmed by this?
We do not have that to my knowledge, but I have not been in deep discussion with the legal team. They're happy with the plaintiffs, and the hearing on the Northern District is October 21st at 10:45 a.m., which is a Monday. So that's coming on pretty fast here. And the judge is a Timothy Batten. And I don't know who appointed Timothy Batten, but that judge has taken this seriously and granted a hearing on the request for injunction.
And how about the Butts County? Anything from that side or only for Spalding?
Only for Spalding so far. So right. they don't have to give you a hearing on your request for injunction. They can ignore it or they can deny it.
And ignoring it does, I mean, like they could just say no. I mean, like they just ignore it. No, nothing just, happens. Just, you have to appeal.
Not rules. We've got a finite date. This is going to happen October 31st. The court's not bound to rule by October 31st. They can rule December 14th if they want to. And so they effectively deny it by refusing to rule. And just what can you do? The urgency passes once Halloween passes. But I do not know. The odds are always a long shot on getting injunctive relief. It's a tough standard. And I tell people, I would rather be surprised and get the injunction than to tell you the odds are good and not get it. It's much easier to come back and say, wow, they did a fantastic job. They got the injunction. Isn't this great? They exceeded my expectations. And that's what I'd rather be reporting in a couple of weeks.
If I can throw out an analogy, is that similar then to the Supreme Court when someone asks for cert that they don't deny it, they just never respond? And so you're left with the lower level?
They rule on cert petitions. They get a one-line order saying your application for cert has been denied.
They answer all requests?
All requests or application for cert is denied.
Interesting. Okay. I was just trying to see if that was something vaguely similar, but apparently not. We do have a voicemail message, and I am throwing this to you cold. I know that you haven't heard it yet, but I think you'll be able to handle this one.
Hello, Andy, Larry. Just wanted to let you know, I think you're doing a wonderful job. Got a question for you and your listeners. Is it better to inform a potential employer, even if they don't ask about being on the registry, or not? The reason I say this, and I'm trying to make this short, is because recently I had a job at a labor company, and it worked for 3.5 months. They never asked me about my criminal history, and I didn't tell them. Then they sent me to another ticket, and were going to anyway, and found out that I was on the registry, and not only did they not send me to the ticket, they let me go. But I got that 3.5 months worth of work. So I was wondering if you thought maybe that would be better while you're looking for another job or not. Anyway, good job. FYP. Bye.
What do you think the proper response there would be to, should you tell the employer up front?
I actually love that question because there is no answer to it. I would answer, which I hate when people do this, I would answer a question with a question. Would you have rather had the 3.5 months worth of work, or would you rather not been hired? I'm guessing that most folks in this situation would prefer the 3.5 months worth of work, because if they didn't ask the question, they clearly cannot say they're firing him because of an omission in his particular case. So therefore, they're firing him because he's on the registry, which means that they never would have hired him had he told them he was on the registry. That would be my guess. Yeah. So therefore, he's 3.5 months better off. But I can't say in all circumstances what's the best thing to do? I would never advise omitting it, something that's asked on an application. I mean, I wouldn't advise that, because that's grounds for termination if you either falsify or omit the application. Now, theoretically, you shouldn't go through the screening process with omitted questions. That should manifest itself, and they should come back to you and say, "Gee, there's three questions here that weren't answered. Would you be so kind as to answer those?" But I think in his case, he was better off doing exactly what he did do.
Yeah, I'm inclined to say it's almost to me, if the employer won't hire you because of it, did you want to work there anyway? Should you tell them? Should you have to tell them? No, but if on the down the line, 2-3 months, they find out something happens and they shit can you. Yes, it would have been better to have the work, but it seems like it would have been better to try and develop an ally with someone that would help you along the way, that maybe provide some level of cover for you, something along those lines.
Well, that's an interesting theory, because theoretically, the 3.5 months of doing good work would develop an ally.
You think, right? But so then you weren't honest with them. You didn't necessarily lie, but you weren't. I guess if they lied on the application saying, "Are you a felon?" and you say no,
but he said they didn't ask that. Why would you volunteer information that you weren't asked?
I agree with that too.
If they ask you, a lot of people get asked about their financial. And even credit reports will run in the hiring process. But if they don't ask, would you go in and say, "Well, I want to tell you guys, I do hang out at the casinos a whole lot, and I do pretty much piss away my paycheck within a day of having it. And I want you to know I could fall prey to poor attendance, and I may have to put my hand in the cookie jar." I mean, why would you volunteer information that's not solicited?
Yeah. I just, in almost every relationship that I've developed with people in the last 5.5 years, as soon as I end up past some initial milestone, and you know, that's some sort of arbitrary marker that I set up, I almost invariably tell them, because A, it's a significant part of my life dealing with the challenges of it. It's a significant gap in my timeline of like, where were you from 08 to 14? And just to provide me some level of cover that I make some crazy weird excuse of like, "Oh, sorry, I have to go. Your children showed up," that like somebody, it's just not some sort of random weird excusing of various situations.
Well, I agree with you. In a personal relationship, you probably at certain intervals, and I'm no expert in personal relationships. If I were, I would have, I wouldn't be alone at this stage of life, but I would say in a personal relationship, but this isn't, the employer sets the rules of what they want to know.
Right.
And they didn't establish that as a rule, as something that they wanted to know. And clearly we can look in the rearview mirror and we can see that they did not receive the information well, because after becoming aware of it, by whatever means they became aware of it, they said, "We don't need you any longer." So it would take a lot of stretching, in my view, to think that after 3.5 months, assuming he's doing a good job, not being a slob, and this just see, that's the part that sometimes people don't tell. They don't say, "Well, in the 3.5 months, I was absent 4 days without an excuse, and I was tardy four other times, and then I got into an altercation with a customer, and I punched his lights out." If he left out critical information, but assuming on the positive side that he was a reliable employee, all of that was for naught, because the minute they found out he was on the registry, they fired him. What would make you think that if they'd have found out before they saw all these splendid skills and commitment, that they would have said, "Oh, well, of course we're going to give you a chance"? If they won't give you a chance after working reliably for 3.5 months, why would they give you a chance without knowing anything about you?
Certainly. And I can almost guarantee you that this listener will be writing back to tell us, "No, I didn't do any of that." But just to speculate and hypothesize on both sides of it, I'm totally with you that we don't know the whole story. We didn't see it. We didn't hear it from, you know, you don't have any way to confirm the story anyway. But so there's our opinion. Registry Matters has spoken, and go forth and prosper.
Well, I'm assuming that a person who had all these sinister things that they could have fired them for would not have phoned that question in, but perhaps they would have. I'm assuming that it's exactly pristine and pure, that he was let go as soon as they discovered he's on the registry and there was nothing else underlying the termination. If I'm a human resource manager and I've got a marginal employee and I find this out, even though I didn't ask initially, I'd say, well, you know, we've been looking for something. Well, my goodness, it looks like something has materialized. So
perfect. Let us move on to this first. It's not even an article. This is a court of appeal from Florida, the second district. This is a man who, as best as I could come up with the story, he is on supervision and he says he was at home. His handler comes out to his place at 6:50 in the morning and knocks on the door and says, "Hey, we need to see you." And he never answers. And eventually then that triggers them to lock him up. And he's challenging him having his probation revoked for not answering the door. And he says that he was asleep, that he had taken some medicine maybe, and that he was knocked out. And, so there you go. So make sure you answer your door, and that way you don't revoke your probation. Ryan's funny. Ryan's in chat. He's like, 6:50 a.m. What the WTF? Bitch, I'm asleep at 6:50. Right. Yeah, but if they come to your door at 2 o'clock in the morning and knock, I promise you, you should wake up. You might not be happy about it, but yeah, you probably should wake up.
Well, this is an interesting case because we say that you have an obligation to answer your door. Well, this guy was under community control, which is a form of custody in Florida. It's a little higher than being on regular probation, but it's an alternative to being the pretty teacher that was having sex with the her name's escaping me at the moment, but the probably the most gorgeous teacher I remember that ever being put on the sex offender registry in Florida. She was put on community control, and there was speculation because she was too pretty to go to prison. But this is where the court looks at. Yes, he could have been in violation. He could have not been home. But what the court is saying is you need to actually do a little bit of work. Because it also could be that he was home and he could have not been able to answer the door. He could have been in the shower, which showers are pretty loud. He could have been fornicating. I mean, he could have been passed out from the effects of alcohol. We don't know. So to conclude a person doesn't answer the door is somehow not home and in violation, it's just too much of a jump. So the court said, no, you don't get to make that quantum leap. You get to go out and look for a little evidence to corroborate your belief, and you didn't have any. So therefore, they put him back on community control.
And so what other reasons might there be that he didn't answer the door? I think, you know, the handler says, well, you obviously weren't home. But before doing like the pre-show research, whatever, we came up with, I don't know, a half dozen other reasons why he might not have answered the door.
Well, I just went through some of them. He could have been passed out because he was drunk. He could have been fornicating. He could have been in the shower. I mean, he could have been disposing of contraband that he was rapidly flushing the toilet. I mean, there could have been a number of things he was doing that he didn't want to answer the door.
He could have been dead.
He could have been dead. I think we can conclude probably that he wasn't dead. That's the basis of the appeal. But this is an example of probation officers not wanting to do any work. If you think your charge is not following curfew, you build a little evidence. You put a surveillance team on them. Most of the larger probation supervision units have surveillance. That's what their job is. And you request, the officer says, I want to put Andy under surveillance. Why do you want to put him under surveillance? Well, X, Y, and Z's happened, and I think we need to gain some. Okay, I'll approve surveillance for 3 days. And they can do that, or they could have waited to see if he comes out of the house, and they could have said, why didn't you answer the door? We want to come in and look around. But they just wanted to jump to the conclusion that he was not there because he didn't answer the door. And the court, in this case, correctly said, you can't do that.
Right. Here we go.
It was an I got you moment. They thought I got you, and they turned out that they didn't get him.
But then, just like we were talking a few minutes ago about retaliation in the Georgia thing, so I'm going to then suspect that his handlers are going to then, if he's 1 minute past whatever his curfew is, or if he has one, they are going to be nailing the screws to him. they were going to be hot on his tail to try and make him mess up.
Well, you could assume that, or you could be like Brenda, and you could think that they have their purest of wind-driven snow, and that they're going to be respectful of the court's opinion, and they're going to try to be more diligent about doing their job, and they're going to learn something from this. I tend to be more skeptical, and I tend to take your view that they're probably not going to learn anything, and they're probably going to be angry that they didn't succeed in revocation, and I suspect they're going to be very carefully monitoring his trash can. I suspect his cell phone's going to get checked out very frequently. I suspect they're going to be all over him because they failed at their revocation, and that doesn't go over. They take this personally, and that's sad because when I was in the landlord business, I tried. I think we even had that pre-show banter. You don't take this stuff personally when someone outsmarts you. You go back and say, you know, I can't believe I let that one get past me. You know, He's pretty good. And then you go back and you correct what you did that allowed him and the probation officer to say, okay, I see what we did wrong. We didn't have enough evidence because we only have to have the greater weighting of the evidence. You don't need proof beyond a reasonable doubt in a revocation because the standard of evidence is so much lower. In this case, according to the opinion, the violation has to be proven by the greater weight of the evidence, which is a standard I'm not familiar with, which would be probably equivalent to preponderance, meaning tipping the scale slightly where that scale is weighing in favor of that's all they had to prove. A good probation officer would go back and say, yep, they got us on that one. Here's what we do next time. We wait it out and we sit out there and we wait and we see what happens. If the vehicle's not here, then we put that in our notes. There was no vehicle if the person owns a vehicle. And that would be an additional corroboration. It wouldn't prove anything, but it would be additional evidence. And then we'll wait and see if they come out. Then we'll call his job and find out. I mean, there's a number of things they could have done to find out the whereabouts of this person other than just assuming he wasn't home.
Now, speaking of being lazy, it's not like NASA wasn't hiring when they were doing their job hunt, and that's how they ended up being probation officers. And I don't want to begrudge any of the dozens of probation officers that would listen to this program. Just that it is not the highest end of jobs, and maybe they just do enough to make sure they get their paycheck to do as minimum to get as much out that they can out of it.
Well, I would say there would be some in that business that would be that way, and I think it has a lot to do with leadership. You know, if I'm in leadership, I'm going to be telling those people, we want to rehabilitate these people. They have to live in our communities with us. And we want, when we discharge these people, we want them to be better units than one. And we can lock them up. We can take the hard-nosed approach. We can violate as many people as we can. But eventually, they're going to come out.
Yeah.
And if you time them out in prison and they don't get any mentoring, they don't get any rehabilitation, are we better as a community? I always try to look at are we better as a community? So I would be instilling into my training that we're better as a community if we rehabilitate these people to the maximum extent possible. So our job is not to find flimsy reasons to violate people. Our job is to find out if people are doing what they're supposed to do, and if not, to figure out how we can inspire them to do the things that'll make them a better unit.
But we've certainly, that when we talked about like the probation, the original charter in the 70s, is that right, as I recall?
Yeah, well,
that was their design.
Yeah. Yeah, the probation goes back a lot further than that. But that was the original intent of probation. And it has evolved now to where I want to see how quickly I can get you. You did your plea.
I got to reduce my caseload. The best way for me to reduce my caseload is to lock all UMFs back up.
It's how quick of a ticket it can be to prison. And that's not good for the probation system. That's not why we have should have a probation system.
Let's move on over to an article from the Crime Report. Can a victory for South Carolina's poorest defendant set a national roadmap? Please drive the bus on this one, if you would, sir.
Well, it could. Was that your only question?
Absolutely. So we can move on to the next one about the from law.com? No, let's go back.
Yeah. Well, this is just a continuation of our discussion about the inadequacy of the public defense system. And this is a case out of, I think, South Carolina. I just barely looked at it before the show and threw it in here. But the ACLU in South Carolina has been pushing to get better representation, and they want a victory. So there's really not a whole lot more needing to be said other than folks, it's our responsibility. If we're going to charge people with crimes, we have to, under our Constitution, provide them adequate defense. And if you don't like the cost of that, perhaps maybe you ought to tell your police to quit bringing so many charges against people, because it's expensive, and that's what we have to do. And that's the Constitution. You put your hand on the Bible and say that you believe in, and you have to do it.
I wonder if there's not a disconnect there. Is the DA is part of judicial, or is the DA part of executive?
Well, sharpen your question a little bit more, because the DA is a player at one of the three prongs of the judicial.
But if cops are called to the scene of a crime and they do the investigation, liberty do they have in actually booking, charging, etc. at their level? Would it be like the first rung of the ladder, do you think?
Well, they have a great deal of discretion in terms of they can often arrest people for crimes that they witness. They can often secure on a low level judge's signature, they can secure an arrest warrant for someone, and they can hand that case over to the DA. But the DA ultimately decides if they're going to move forward with it, because the DA assumes control once the case is handed off to them.
Yeah,
I don't know if that's where you're headed, but
I'm looking at the various different stopgaps along the way that, a cop pulls you for, somebody even wrote back after we talked about the speed limit thing. They said they got pulled over in Southern Virginia for like 3 miles over. So a cop pulls you over and they can say, oh, you're doing 9 miles over, I don't give you a ticket. Oh, you're doing 3 miles over, I do give you a ticket. They have that level of discretion. I realize a ticket's probably not going to trigger you seeing the DA, but after your 30th ticket, you're probably going to end up seeing the DA. The DA decides, well, we're going to do some diversionary tactic. You're going to go and you're going to seek some sort of driver counseling, whatever. And that completely avoids any sort of prison system. But another DA goes, psh, we're going to nail the screws to you, and we're going to prosecute you, and we're going to send you to court.
And what is our question in there?
I'm trying to see, you said, can the police stop, charging people, arresting people? That would be the first step of the pipeline to dismantle it or slow down the flow, so that indigent defense people, there would be more resources, because there would be fewer cases that the public defenders would be needing to see. My question originally was, what level of discretion do the police have in charging and all that of the process?
Well, they have as much discretion as they choose to have. Police agencies also have political considerations. If you work for the police department, oftentimes you're under the discretion of a mayor who's elected by the voters. And if the voters want to see heavy-handed enforcement, you could take an example of Rio Rancho, one of our bedroom communities out here. The Rio Rancho police are notoriously aggressive on traffic, notoriously aggressive enforcers, because the people of that town demand that. They want aggressive enforcement. So what discretion the police have is what discretion they're given by their command.
And their
command often leads all the way back up to the city hall, to the mayor's office, and to the city council.
Right. So the shit rolls downhill, as the expression goes. Is the DA driving that also?
No, the DA is the last on the rung. The DA doesn't have an investigative body that's out arresting people. When's the last time you've heard of anybody that got arrested by the DA?
I get that, but I'm wondering if the DA is talking to the sheriffs that are driving, hey, we're going to arrest people for this. These are the things that we're actually going to prosecute. I'm wondering if it trickles down even from that higher up on the echelons.
Well, I've heard DAs say that we won't prosecute certain things, like harassing phone calls. We had a DA in New Mexico that said, in Albuquerque, said, I no longer prosecute those cases. It's too low of a priority, and it consumed too much time. But for the DA to tell the police what that they're going to spend their resources on to investigate and bring to them, I don't know that that happens. I don't know that it doesn't happen. It seems like to me that that's going to be more of a police function, how they want to allocate their resources. And they hand the case file over to the DA when they think they've got enough. Then the DA still says yes or no. You don't have enough, or yes, I'll take this case and go forward.
And I don't want to beat this dead horse for too much longer. But then also, like, it's completely disconnected from the finance side of it, that they know what they are supposed to charge people with as far as crimes. So they are just executing on their job of doing those things. And we, the people, should vote to have fewer laws that would get prosecuted this way. That way the police don't have to make those decisions.
That sounded convoluted.
Sorry. I put all of this that we, the people, are the problem, that we vote for the politicians that make more stringent laws than the police and the DA are sort of forced to then prosecute the laws that we, the people, ask them to go make illegal things.
Well, I take it a step further than that. I say we, the people, give the police too many resources.
Yes.
Which means that in order for them to justify those resources, they have to do things they would not do without those resources. So I continue to say that the way you stop the enormous amount of police work is to stop the enormous number of police that we have on the streets. Now, that goes contrary to the hype about the crime rates through the stratosphere, and completely reject that, because I say it's the safest time to be alive. But people are fearful because they don't know the real facts. They believe that it is such a dangerous time, and you know, I just don't know how to combat ignorance, because people believe that crime is rampant when it's the best time to be alive.
Right. Yes, I'm completely with you. No, and that's kind of the direction I was going too, about them having so many resources that they're running around with full SWAT gear all the time. And, you know, they buy the tank in wherever that was, in Tennessee, I think it was. It seems excessive to me that they are supposed to be to serve and protect, I think it is. But I showed Ryan a clip. There's a movie called Transformers. You may have heard of it. It came out about 10 or 15 years ago, but the car said to, like, dominate and enslave. And I kind of feel this way about the police at this point, is that they're not necessary. I'm not saying they are not trying to protect and serve, but they are very much enslaving and dominating.
Well, it's like, and I've lost track of, I haven't looked at the latest Bernalillo County budget for what the Sheriff's Department has for the Sex Offender Registration Tracking Unit. It was either 5 or 6 full-time equivalent detectives to track 900 sex offenders. So they had a caseload of over 100. They may have more detectives now, but if you've got 6 detectives and you have to go before the county commission to get your budget every year for that particular unit, if you're not making any cases and your command staff says, well, how many cases did the sex none. Oh, so you still need 6? Oh, yes. Well, what are you doing? Nothing. I mean, they're under pressure if you've got 6 detectives to produce some prosecution. So that's why they're waiting with the stopwatch when you go to your 91st day. And I generally poo-poo the thing about radiation, but that is one instance where they are actually waiting with the stopwatch. And although it isn't radiation, they are hoping that you violate. That's why our Department of Public Safety refuses to carry out the law that says, and has said since 2013, that a first-class letter will be sent to the person at least 15 days before renewal date, and they want those violations to happen. So since the Department of Public Safety is a part of the law enforcement apparatus, they don't follow the law, and they make sure that they violate many people. But what would the county commission say if, after the second or third year in a row, when they came in and said, well, how is the sex offender unit doing? Oh, we haven't made a single case. Do you think they'd be inclined to continue to allocate 6 detectives?
I would. It seems like they would allocate fewer.
Well, that's the whole point I'm making. So yes, the fact that they have the resources is what drives prosecution. Let's bring that. Of course, I don't want it in law enforcement at all, because it's a civil regulatory scheme. But while we're making that transition, let's bring that detective down to 1.
Yes.
And have 1 detective rather than 6 or 7 or whatever they may have now. And then you will actually be following, and if you're following the law and you're sending out those letters and they get returned as undeliverable, then that one detective opens an investigation on that case and says, oh, well, we received a letter that says no longer this residence, and you can knock at the door. Does Andy live here? No, he doesn't. Oh, do you have any idea? And then you have probable cause to go out and conduct an investigation, rather than going out with your goon squads with 7 detectives at the door with their gun, their hands on their triggers. I mean, it's so intimidating and so over the top when they do these residence verifications. And it's all for show. It's all for show. That's all this is. It's just like the airport security that TSA does when they grab your crotch and they go up and down and they go up and down. That's all for show.
Yes.
That's not keeping you any safer.
I got a quick little tangent for you. Did you hear about the lady that made it all the way on the plane without boarding pass or ID or anything?
I did, and I published a general rule for that. So,
what's the general rule?
I would say if you manage to be good enough to pass the TSA checkpoint, and there are layers of security before you get past and into the concourse area. If you manage to get past without either identification or a boarding pass, and then you manage to get on an aircraft without a boarding pass, as a general rule, when a person says, "You have my seat," I would surrender that seat and look for another vacant seat on that aircraft. If there's not another vacant seat, I would exit the aircraft, and I would hope that I could pull the same magic again. Because unless you're completely certifiable, you know that you know that you don't belong on that aircraft. So you know that the person saying you're in my seat probably has a valid document that says it's their seat. So you should probably surrender that seat and hope there's another open one. That would be my general rule that I would recommend.
I think that's fair. But if it's a 99% booked flight, you are going to be bouncing from seat to seat to seat. Someone's going to notice you at some point.
Well, if it's assigned seats, but like Southwest, there's no assigned seating. So with Southwest, what you could do is first come, first serve. And then if it's a completely sold out plane, then they're eventually, when they have one person standing, they're going to say, well, gee, we have exactly 138 seats sold, and there should be seats for everybody. So at that point, they're going to start looking for everybody's boarding pass. They're going to say, everybody, please hold up your boarding pass. We're going to come through the cabin. And at that point, you're going to need to exit the aircraft. But you'd have a better luck with Southwest because you don't need to have a particular seat. You just need to hope there's an open seat on that flight.
So our wonderful TSA somehow let her get through screening and everything else along the way.
Every system failed along the way, and it's remarkable. I would want to know how she did it. I would not be interested in prosecution. I'd be interested in figuring out how she pulled off this feat.
Excellent. All right, then let's move on over to law.com, the Connecticut Law Tribune. State High Court upholds constitutionality of sentencing child to 40 years imprisonment. How do we get to the place where a 14-year-old gets a 40-year sentence and tried as an adult?
Well, because he killed somebody.
Couldn't we easily argue that a 14-year-old's brain isn't quite developed, and while you may want to confine him for some kind of sort of extended period of time, but not put them in adult stuff, right?
Well, that's not what the people of Connecticut decided.
Isn't that the live free or die place? Or is that New Hampshire?
I think that's New Hampshire.
Oh, my bad. All right, then I don't know what Connecticut's slogan is.
So, but yeah, this is I couldn't help myself. This actually appeared in the Criminal Daily Justice briefing. But it appears that the decision actually was rendered back on August 23rd. So it's over a month since it's out, but it just popped up on my radar yesterday. But I put it in here because it talks about the evolving standards of decency. And those who believe in an evolving standards of decency, and I tied this to, we're going to hear from the late Justice Scalia later today about the evolving standards of decency. This is he's not such a young man, he's in his 30s now, but this is a person who committed a horrible act at age 14. And then Connecticut has since made it more difficult to sentence him to that outcome. But he would still be eligible for a tough sentence. And this is him making the argument that based on the fact that Connecticut made it tougher to put juveniles in adult court, that the standards of decency have evolved. And the court said, well, they have evolved, but they've evolved precisely along the lines of what the statute says, PA 15-84. And they said, therefore, under PA 1584, you can still get this sentence. Now you're eligible for parole now, which you weren't previously before the amendments was made. So you're eligible to be paroled after 24 years, which is not that many years from now because he's been in for quite some time. And they said, so therefore, we decline to invent something that the lawmakers didn't put in their reforms. We're just judges here, and they made the reforms they wanted as reflected by the people's will, and we're not going to evolve beyond that. That's I mean, this is, those of you who are textualists out there, you should be clapping and you should be applauding and you should be so happy that you don't have a court in Connecticut, that this is the state's highest court. The Connecticut Supreme Court isn't legislating from the bench, and they're not interpreting more than what the law provided for to give people breaks beyond what the elected officials. This should be music to your ears, those of you who are textualists.
Well, tell me your lefty view on this. Should the court have stepped in and super legislated?
I'm not a big fan of super legislating. I'm one of those where in rare circumstances, I'm not in favor of having the whole thing in Connecticut's flawed. I like our system where putting a juvenile and adult court is exceedingly difficult and seldom happens. So under our system, he never would have been in adult court. You remember I tell the story about Cody Posey, who was 14 at the time, and all he did was kill his father and his mother and his sister. And they could not put him in adult court under our stringent standards here. So we take care of the whole problem on the front side. We make sure that it can't happen because they have to show that the juvenile is not amenable to any rehabilitation anywhere in the state. And they have to prove that by a very high standard. And I forget what it is, but Ashley could probably tell us next time we have her on. But no, I don't believe that in this case that they should legislate from the bench. I believe that the legislature made the adjustments that the people wanted. And this guy, he's getting the benefit of that change, and he's wanting more than what the legislature prescribed, and so therefore, he loses. And like I say, the textualists and the people who don't want legislating from the bench, they should be applauding. This is exactly what you would want.
I do want to point out, though, that you're not just passively involved in your legislative process. You are pretty high up on the ladder of people driving the way the policy even is developed. You're part of that whole, as you call it, apparatus. Is that a fair way to articulate it?
Well, I wouldn't put it quite that strong. I'm connected enough that
Mr. Humility.
I know more than the average person does in terms of what's going on here, and I'm very closely. And I'm able to get information faster and more efficiently than most people. I can know what's happening from behind.
But the average Joe just knows that we go to the polls and we vote blue or red, and be damned, I'm not voting for the other team because they're a terrible group of people. I mean, that is, I think a very large portion of our population considers politics to that degree. So team red votes this way, team blue votes this way. That's who I vote for. That's the end of the whole conversation. Doesn't matter that these people kind of push down these sorts of policies. These people push down those sorts of policies. People typically don't follow it that way.
So, well, we're still focused on what the court didn't do. The court did not legislate from the bench, right?
Correct. The law specifically stated a thing. Your law states something different, where they wouldn't be able to do this to begin with. The reason why your state is different than Connecticut is because of people such as yourself that are very heavily involved. And there are probably people in Connecticut that are as involved, and they want to approach things in a different way.
That is correct, and I can't take a lot of credit for the juvenile justice system we have here. There was a whole lot of people that worked on this very hard a couple decades ago, and we saw the light before other states have seen the light. That's the time to save people and to do your best in rehabilitation. So there's been a lot of effort put into our juvenile system. Now there are people saying that we're just too lenient and that the juveniles are doing some heinous thing. We're hearing about the super predator again, because we're too lax on juveniles. And this is the potential for an overreaction. When one juvenile does something heinous, then everybody that suddenly becomes, oh, well, we've got a tidal wave of juvenile crime. Well, we've had several high profile juvenile cases, and it seems like that the media is really focused on that, and that's causing the public to demand that we be a little tougher on juveniles.
Interesting. How about we hop on over to a article from the Marshall Project and it looks like all 800 different Democratic candidates and what their various criminal justice policies would be, because there are, I don't know, are there still 20 people running, something like that?
A few have dropped out, and I'll only put this in here just so that people who might be open-minded enough to look at the article, I didn't want to spend a lot of time on it, to see what things that they say that they're for might actually be things that Democrats are for, because you know, we've got an audience that tends to lean toward the conservative side, and which means that Democrats are crappy people as far as many of our listeners are concerned. And you might look at this and find out that you agree with more than what you think you do. You know, do you support decriminalizing illegal border crossing? Do you support the death penalty? Should sentencing include mandatory minimums? Almost all of our people would say mandatory minimums are bad. Well, we got mandatory minimums because of that was the stylish thing to do back when crime was high on everybody's agenda back in the 90s, and that became a bipartisan thing to be tough. And boy, did we get tough!
Then profiles where each of them are. Like, I mean, just one thing that I know offhand is like Bernie is in favor of people being able to vote even while they're still in prison, and then the various different positions of the candidates. It's kind of like a neat laid out article, like very visual, and things are kind of moving around to do little bubbles, like the cartoon bubbles over their people's heads as it rotates through them.
Yeah, and they mention in there that the Trump directive to seek maximum penalties, some of the Democratic candidates would certainly unravel that if they were to win, you know, because he issued that directive right after the Jeff Sessions that we would seek the maximum penalty and all the enhancements we can on prosecutions. And so that is really not the right direction to move on crime, in my view, but that's where we are.
Interesting. They lump everybody into one big category to eliminate the death penalty. They all are in favor of eliminating the death penalty.
So it said, it said well, most immediately a new administration could go through its attorney general and reverse the 2017 Jeff Sessions memo that requires federal prosecutors to seek the most severe possible penalties. By contrast, under President Obama, Attorney General Eric Holder ordered federal prosecutors in 2013 to exercise restraint in charging to limit the number of people facing harsh mandatory minimums. So that's a contrast.
Yeah.
And that's what I would expect. But anyway, like I said, I didn't want to spend a lot of time.
Yeah, I know.
To give people a chance to look over it. And I know that here's what people tell me when I say, look, what you say you're for in criminal justice is not what the party you support is for. And they said, well, I have to look at the bigger picture. And I said, well, so does everyone else. We all look at the bigger picture. We don't just look at, I don't know anybody that votes just on criminal justice alone. I don't. I voted, yeah. I look at the bigger picture. I kind of resent someone thinking, I don't look at the bigger picture. I look at public health. I look at the social safety net. I look at crime. I look at the environment. I look at all the economic facts. I mean, I look at everything that you look at. What makes you think you have the monopoly on looking at the bigger picture? I look at the bigger picture also.
Definitely.
Don't you?
No, I'm a one issue voter. That's it. I just want good streets.
But I've had so many people tell me, well, Larry, I have to look at the bigger picture. And I said, well, that's precisely what I do. I just look at the bigger picture slightly different than you do.
Yeah, it's just people. I don't know, but there are certainly a lot of people that are one issue voters. That is for damn sure. People either they pick whatever their little pet peeve issue is and nothing else matter. We could scorch the earth, but as long as we got that one issue, nothing else matters.
There are some people out there that they would vote entirely on abortion.
Yes, that is the issue I was thinking of, but I wasn't saying.
If you say that you'll ban abortion, do you have their vote no matter what else that you stand for? That's the sole deciding issue for them. And then those people, when they have that, boy, we're going to go down a rat hole now, but when those people, when you engage in a debate with them and you say, okay, well, what do we do with 500,000 or 600,000 children we would force to be carried to term on an annual basis, when we've got that many in foster care that are long term that can't be placed, what would we do with them? They never will answer that question. They will come up, well, adoption. I'll say, okay, well, let's be optimistic. Adoptions will take care of maybe a fifth of them or a fourth of them. What will we do there? And they never will tell you. They will not tell you what the answer is to deal with all those that would be born if you forced all pregnancies to go to term. And so that's what I would like to have a discussion about at some stage, but not on this program. I'd like for one of those people who feels that way to engage me and tell me what we're going to do with those unwanted children.
I agree. I would not be opposed to having it on, and you know, we could segment off the content if we needed to. Anywho, how about we move on over to this is a governor that I wore a certain kind of color on my face when I was a teenager in college. From WHSV, Virginia governor says he restored civil rights to 22,000 felons. This is Virginia Governor Ralph Northam says he's restored the voting rights and other civil rights to more than 22,000 felons who have completed their sentences since he took office last year. What's your point here, Larry?
My point is that there is a trend where people who have been disenfranchised are being re-enfranchised, and I'm encouraging you to vote. And this is a case where the previous administration of Governor Terry McAuliffe, he had done a blanket restoration, and the conservatives challenged that, said he didn't have the authority or did not do a blanket. He had to do an individual restoration one by one. So this is the individualized restoration of getting people back on the voting rolls. And there's just such a paranoia in the conservative side about letting felons vote. Somehow or another, they're going to vote Democratic. And I don't understand that, because most of the felons I deal with are conservative, and they wouldn't vote for a Democrat if their life depended on it. So right. I don't know where the fear comes from, but anyway, this is just a great thing for those 22,000 that have been restored. And the process is happening around the country where barriers were removed in Florida by the public referendum. And now the conservatives have come in and tried to build all these barriers despite the public voting. I think it was substantially in favor of restoring people after they'd done their time in Florida. They're putting these things that they have to pay all their court costs and everything that they did may have been not paid before they can actually be restored to vote, because they're afraid that these hundreds of thousands of Floridians are going to vote for the liberal do-gooders, and there's just no evidence to support that. There's just none.
So, as I recall in Florida, it was somewhere around 2/3 to 3/4 voted to remove Amendment 4, and then the legislature came in behind them and started trying to tack on things to keep them from voting.
Yes. So
that is how my memory serves.
I wish the conservatives would come tell me what their fear is. Of course, they tell me what their fear is, that they're going to vote Democratic, but I wish they would show me some evidence of how they've concluded that this tidal wave of new voters are going to vote Democratic.
Very much so. All right, then, from stltoday.com, St. Louis Post-Dispatch, advocates call for Missouri to join other states in lifting time limits on child sex abuse lawsuits. I want to jump to the very end of this article. If I can remember when I was reading it at lunch today, it says in about the fifth to the end paragraph, the Missouri Catholic Conference testified against efforts to remove the civil statute of limitations because it could open the church to lawsuits that are difficult to defend because of lack of evidence or clear memory. There, I rest my case.
That's not my whole point, but that's one of my big points, that this is a trend. We've talked about it on the podcast several times, and all I'm getting is pop-ups in the stories I try to open it, but I've already read it, so I don't need to read it again. But this is one of those things where in a civil lawsuit, you're not facing loss of liberty. That is true. But you are facing loss of property and everything you've worked for, and the standard of proof is far lower because it's a civil case. You don't have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. You have to prove by a preponderance of the evidence. And you have these people coming back decades later, saying, he did this. What can you do? What can you do? There's nothing you can do to defend yourself against this.
I don't know. I think about it. I constantly refer back to me sitting on the jury trial for a DEA guy in Macon, and the quote unquote victim was suing him civilly that he forced her, compelled her, extorted her to take some nudie photos, and in exchange for not prosecuting, blah, blah, blah. I personally believed the officer, but there was no evidence. So I was like, I think I was the jury foreman at that point too. And I was like, there's no evidence. I agree that he probably did it, but we have no evidence. So we voted and he was acquitted because there was no evidence. Show me the pictures.
So, well, that's a rarity that you actually need evidence.
That was, I was like, how can we just take, if the two of the people are of equal in their words, and you would then believe the DEA guy more because he's a more respectable citizen than a person that is constantly caught up in drug charges and so forth. But again, back to the evidence side of it. That's just how I came down on it, and I convinced the other 11 people that we should not convict the guy.
Well, you didn't need to convict 11. You only needed to convince one.
Fair enough. But we came back with a unanimous. Yeah, I guess that would be hung jury. But we came back with a unanimous decision of not guilty. I'm with you. I understand.
Yeah. And that's the best verdict, because then the state doesn't get a second chance. When you have a hung jury, the state gets another chance. Okay. And as I've discussed this with people, the case gets better for the state, because when you're putting on your second prosecution, you've had the opportunity to poll the jurors and find out what T's and I's you didn't deal with, who was not credible in the witness lineup, what evidence they would like to have heard that would have cinched the deal. And when you put your second and third and fourth trial on, until finally the court shuts it down and says this case is dismissed with prejudice, if you have a second or a third hung jury, the state gets a better outcome. It doesn't work to benefit the defendant to go on trial the second and third time,
because they learn what they didn't do appropriately or correctly, and they can then hone their skills and sharpen their saw to figure out the better way to chop it down.
Absolutely. And the defense doesn't know they don't get to be there when they're polling the jurors for the prosecution's polling the jurors. The defense can do their own thing. They can poll the jurors as well. But the state benefits from it, because they want to try the person again. They want to find out what they did wrong and why it wasn't convincing enough. And then they put on a better case the second time around.
There was another quote in there I want to say from some law professor that says that our entire judicial system is based on being able to have some sort of fair trial. I can't remember. I guess it was at the, I can't remember exactly what it was, but there was a statement made in there that our whole system is based on that. You have to be able to defend yourself with evidence, and you have to have that robust kind of trial thing going on.
Well, those of us who believe in our adversarial system, I'm not so sure that the majority of Americans, or at least a significant number of Americans, believe in the adversarial system anymore, because if they did, they would not be so willing to abolish the things that make it an adversarial system. It's not an adversarial system if you muzzle the defense and you don't let them do vigorous cross-examination, because that's re-victimizing the victim. It's, you know, if you're not allowed to call witnesses that are relevant, I'm not so sure that our people really do support the adversarial system anymore. I don't know what we're moving towards, but it's certainly not an adversarial system, which given the opportunity and the resources, the adversarial system is a very fine system, but we don't have that anymore.
Agreed. There was something else. I was just kind of scrolling through the article, but this one really jumped out at me. You're a fairly smart individual, Larry. Do you know how averages work, right?
Not really, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, Hamilton, this is my favorite person on the planet, Marcy Hamilton, said the average age for a child abuse victim to come forward is 52. For that to be true, that means more or less half of the people on the front side of that have to be true. So somewhere between the ages of, you know, whenever, like 5, when their thing actually happened, all the way to age 52. But that also means an equal number of people on the other side. That means 62, 72, 82. That number is complete garbage. There's no way the average age is 52. I call bullshit right there.
Well, I'm not sophisticated enough to call that bullshit based on that. But what I can call it is that maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But we cannot have our adversarial system work effectively when you come forward at age 52 for something that happened when you were 7.
Certainly.
Sorry, we can't. We feel bad for you.
Yes.
And it's tragic. But we can't do anything for you because it's too late. The person who we would potentially put in a cage can't defend themselves because you waited too long.
Yeah. And so, there's an expression that people say that everyone says that they're an above average driver, which is impossible because then the average would move and everyone would become average of quality driver. There's no way that number's 52.
So,
but I'm with you. Yeah, there's no way that you could turn around and have a fair trial for someone 30, 40, 50 years removed.
Well,
even probably 10 years is probably really hard to do without some sort of hard evidence.
But you don't dare ask the victim's advocates that when they're advocating for this. You don't dare suggest that because they become righteously indignant. If you ask them, well, you do believe in fair play, and you do believe in well, you tell my victim that. You tell this person whose life was ruined, you tell them that. I said, well, I'm not in that part of the discussion. I'm on the side that tries to make sure that people get due process, and what you're doing is going to wreck any hope of them getting due process. And I'm sorry that what happened. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't. We can't give the person due process who you're trying to put in a cage. We can't. So therefore, we can't give you what you want, which is an open-ended statute of limitations. Sorry, the answer is no. But I'm in a slim minority. If you were to poll the average, I think if you poll the average voter, when you emotionalize the question and say, well, do you think a person who's committed a sex offense against a child, do you think that after a period of time they should just get away with it? And that's the way you would ask the question.
Of course. It's certainly a leading question that way. That's not a fair way to.
And of course, 99.8725% would say no, that they shouldn't get away with it.
And you would certainly find that most people would say that they should not get away with it. Like ever, you should hunt them even in their grave and lock them up after they're in their grave. But that's then the slippery slope of where do you cut that off for what crimes? Does it apply to burglary? Does it apply to just all of the other crimes?
Well, in Maryland, it does. All felony crimes are fair game.
Well, that's Brenda's fault then. Get on that, Brenda.
Yeah, well, she didn't know about it until it was too late because I was surprised when we found out that was the case. When I said, well, what's the statute of limitations? And we started looking into it, and when we asked the former chief public defender, she said there isn't one.
Crazy. All right. Then over at the Washington City Paper, not a publication I've ever heard of, and even growing up in that area, but it could just be an online publication. DC defendants wear ankle monitors that can record their every word and motion. Obviously, a GPS monitor on your leg would be intended to record where you are. But they have little cell phones in them, and they can, without any sort of indication to the wearer, that they have turned on the recording functionality. And some guy was at work with his leg monitor on, and it said there was a voice that popped on and said, hey, you're not where you're supposed to be. And it freaked out his manager, and he got fired because the GPS monitoring company hadn't gotten notice that he was allowed to be at work past, you know, whatever, 10 o'clock, whatever his curfew said. This is funny.
Well, I'm glad you finally have a sense of humor.
This is crazy, Larry. And there was another thing in there that really triggered me, and it said that you cannot sleep while it's charging, I think it said, which is asinine to me. Like, you're going to be tethered. I don't know if you remember at the meeting, but there was a guy, Jason, he had his ankle monitor on. I didn't realize he was on an ankle monitor, but he was sitting very close to a plug so that he could have the thing charging while he was sitting there at the meeting in Georgia.
I didn't even think of that, but yes, he was.
Oh my God. It was crazy. I didn't realize that
I thought he was afraid of getting cooties or something.
But look, man, I'm all technologically enabled and all this stuff. And even I watch you do this with your phone. You have like a 3-foot cord and you try and do contortionist acts to get your phone plugged into the wall. Get a really long cord and get a battery and you can then be on the move and not be tethered to a wall. And you could charge those Dumaflatches with that sort of rig and just put the battery in your pocket and keep on the moving.
Well, This is a case of technology has gotten beyond the law. The courts have not dealt with this. It's a matter of first impression. About, I think that the manufacturer, one of those monitors, said that there's a feature that it either vibrates or it makes a beep when they start listening. But they, it turns out they can actually turn that off.
Correct.
And so therefore it has the feature. And there's no requirement that it at least tell you it's getting ready to listen. So you go to your lawyer's office and say, I think my PO's out to get me. And the PO's listening to the conversation with your lawyer. So the lawyer is asking that the thing be removed until he can have it examined to figure out what its capabilities are. So
this is spectacular. Yeah, this is very troubling that they could all of a sudden, you could be in the middle of taking care of your own personal needs and they turn the thing on. And just having, like, I realize that you should have a reduced expectation of privacy, but I don't think that you should be living your life in the middle of just completely out in the open for the public to, or anybody to spy on you and listen in.
Well,
that's ridiculous.
I agree. You do have, while you're under correctional control, but see, the problem with this GPS monitoring business is the universe of monitored people has expanded to not be people, just include people who have been convicted of a crime, but everybody who's pre-trial is on some sort of GPS monitoring. When I say everybody, I'm not literally meaning everybody, but a huge number of people pre-trial have these things. They haven't been convicted of anything.
So where's your presumption of innocence, right?
That's what I've been saying to lawmakers when I get the chance. I said, well, wait a minute. You believe that a person's presumed innocent until they either plead guilty or they're found guilty beyond reasonable. Well, yes, of course I believe that. Well, then how on earth can you justify all these restrictions on their liberty? I mean, I have a problem with requiring people to do very many things pre-trial because they have not been convicted.
But the whole legal apparatus wouldn't have descended upon this person had they not had decent evidence, right?
Well, theoretically they have probable cause, but but probable cause, depending on the jurisdiction, can be merely a prosecutor's filing of an affidavit of an information, not an affidavit, but a prosecutor saying probable cause. It doesn't take much to put someone on pretrial control. And I know it's for the benefit of public safety, but we don't have any basis to presume that these people need to be kept safe from anything. They haven't been convicted of anything. How do we conclude that we need to keep the public safe? And boy, this will drive the victim's advocates over the edge. Well, Larry, what you're saying is that if he beats up his girlfriend, black and blue, then you're telling me that we can't put him on GPS monitoring to keep. No, I didn't say that. For a particularized reason, for that alone, for boundary control, if there's an order saying that they have to stay so many feet, that would be an appropriate use of the GPS monitoring. It's not to punish, it's to keep the person out of the zone where that they could not continue to harass the witness and interfere with the witness. But this, I mean, everybody is on pretrial control now, and hardly anybody posts a bond, and that's all there is to it. Even the states where they have bond, where they still have cash bond, you post your $10,000 bond, and then you also report to pretrial. And then pretrial says, and by the way, we're going to require a weekly drug test. We're going to require you call into the UA line. We're going to require that you do this and get counseling. Well, wait a minute, I'm innocent. I'm presumed innocent. You're going to require all this stuff while I'm waiting? Oh, yes.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Let's move over to something that somebody sent to me personally. So this is one of our two articles covering Georgia tonight. This is from Floyd Count for Floyd County Schools. Dear parent or guardian, Floyd County Schools is pleased to announce that we will begin using the Raptor Visitor Management System in all of our schools to strengthen our program of campus safety for student and faculty. This is a whole shenanigans thing where they're going to scan your ID, and if you are on the SO list, you will not be entering our campus without our knowledge. This is kind of frightening, kind of Orwellian, that you could have done your crime 300 years ago, and they're still going to find you on the registry somewhere, and they're going to deny you access to the school.
So that's what the SO is. That's not the sheriff's office. That's the...
No, that's our people's national, not national, but individual states list. I don't like using the SO term. So registered citizen.
Well, what if they're not a citizen? What if they're a foreign national when they're registered?
Oh boy. Then yeah, I guess that registered citizen thing has a short-sighted view of things. Yeah, registered persons.
Yes, that would be more accurate, a registered person, because we don't know that they're citizens necessarily.
And this came to my attention because obviously one of our people lives in Floyd County, and this is ridiculous that he is trying to become more engaged in his kid's life, and this very well would prevent him from doing that, that he would have to identify himself as being on the registry to get the permission, even if they don't restrict his access, but then he would be identified, and that could lead to the whole shaming thing that many of our people are burdened with.
This is a phenomenon that's sweeping the nation. This is your great technological advances. Woo-hoo! that you're so proud of. This is,
we need more.
When technology is available, there's going to be a consumer out there, and the Rio Rancho, remember I've mentioned Rio Rancho earlier, the Rio Rancho public schools adopted this a few years back, and if you go on campus, you're going to have this system check you out to see if you're on the sex offender registry, and if you are, they don't admit you to the school. Now, I think this person submitted it because it said that she can't, or her son can't pick up his kids from school. Now, when we had that discussion, I think picking up the kids from school is different than going inside the school and picking up your kids and checking them out at a non-dismissal time. But for the life of me, I don't see how this would prevent you from pulling up onto the school property in the school bus and the student pickup zone and picking up your kid, because how would they run Raptor when you simply drive onto the campus and your kid is sitting there with their backpack and they jump in the car? How would it prevent you from picking your kid up? Now, it would prevent you from going at a non-dismissal time and saying, I want to check my kid out of school, I got to do so and so. That would prevent you, I suppose, but I don't know how this would prevent you from picking your child up from school.
Totally agree. I just, you know, then we could deal with the term school campus. I mean, to me, campus would mean the entire property of the school.
Well, literally, to me it does. It would mean that, but realistically, when you go on a campus, you're only confronted with checks when you get into the building. Very few schools have the resources where there's a gated entrance where they're running IDs at the entrance of the school boundary. Can you name out what's the schools you know that are doing that you can think of off the top of your head?
Oh, I certainly don't know of any. This is just a little bit of I don't know if this is exaggeration on the disability that this is imposing upon the person. I don't know how many other, I've never seen one of these personally come through our system that we had to talk about. But
it's becoming the norm. To keep the kids safe, because parents are on campus for various reasons, legitimately. They go on campus and they accompany field trips. And this is a system that's being used to keep. I mean, last time I was on a bus, I mean, we actually had parents on buses back in my day. Believe it or not, we had buses back in my day, and it never occurred to me that a parent would molest a child on a school bus, or some kind of outing where you've got all the observation you have. And of course, we have far more today because there's more cameras and there's cell phone video and there's everything everywhere, which we didn't have in the 1960s. But this is much to do with hooey about nothing, because nothing happens at the school anyway. Other than what the teachers and coaches do. I'm not saying nothing happens, but when is the last time that anybody in our vast listening audience can think of when some parent has gone on school campus that was not a part of the school faculty, not a part of the coaching staff, not affiliated with the school system, and did anything to a child, I can't think of ever hearing of it in my life.
Right. I agree with that, too. There's just too many people that someone's going to, again, like I used the example. Someone actually was cracking up. They said they got Red Bull in their nose when I said something about spontaneously molesting somebody. But I can't imagine someone going to a school and like picking a kid up, holding them like a football, and running out of the school. It's just not going to happen.
Well, when would you get the privacy? Let's say, I guess you could theoretically be on campus legitimately to give you a hall pass. I guess you could go into a restroom and you could find a student in there that was skipping class and went to do a smoke joint or whatever they do it these days in schools. We used to skip and go do. But when you started molesting the kid, at some point, somebody's going to scream, right?
I would think so. That would be my thought, that you, like, it would be really hard to do it and get away with it without having someone around you notice that someone is screaming bloody murder, that no, don't touch me in my weird spot.
Well, in every school of any size, and I don't want to say every school period, but every school, I know that the charter schools around here, they pretty much all have camera surveillance in the corridors. I know one particular charter school, the principal says, not only do we have it in all the common areas, we have cameras in all the classrooms. And she said that she had to fight with her teachers over that because they thought they were watching the teachers. And she said, no, we're not actually watching the teachers. We're watching the teachers per se. If a student makes an accusation that you did something, we just simply go look at the camera and say, well, we don't show any evidence of the kind. It's there for your protection. Yes. But with all the surveillance, I can't imagine that there's any justifiable fear of an adult being on campus as a child molester and actually perfecting it's absurd.
It is. Same thing with all of the police misconduct that's going on along, you know, probably 95% of police activity is on the up and up, but we do have multiple camera angles of people pulling out their cell phones, challenging the police. And, you know, everyone has a fairly capable recording device in their pocket at all times. And the reason why we have it is because we have those devices. Not prior to the current era did we have that. Can you imagine what would happen now? Everyone would pull out their cell phones to watch you taking the kid out, and they would certainly have your ID covered in a matter of minutes because your face is going to be almost like a 3D scan of it with all the cameras taking you from all the different angles.
Yep.
All right. So we will move on. I didn't realize that this article was from Lenore Scanese from Reason Magazine. Manchester teen faces sex offender status for touching a 17-year-old on the arm and waist. Touching someone's arm to get their attention, I would have thought was normal. This is silly. It is in Manchester, England. So I think Charles sent it to us because those are his people.
Yes, I was going to say that's probably our expert to consult with. How does this happen in your sophisticated country?
And last fall in Manchester, England, an awkward 19-year-old male student touched a 17-year-old female classmate's arm on the street during the daytime. He later said he had wanted to make a friend, and this rattled the girl, and she lost her mind and charged and went to the police and all this. And turns out that he possibly is going to get charged and all that and get put on the registry in England. This is silly.
I think he's been charged, if I read it right.
I may have read it wrong.
It said his hearing that Jamie Griffiths was convicted of two charges of sexual assault, in part because the accuser, now 18, said that she, quote, had no doubt that had she not moved away from him the first time he touched her arm, he would have gone on to touch her breast. But see, that's speculative. He didn't touch your breast. He touched your arm. That is not a sexual erogenous zone. I hate to break it to you.
It might be for someone, though.
But he didn't touch your breast. And first of all, you don't know that he would have. I mean, that's speculation.
Yes.
But he, by your own testimony, I find him not guilty. He didn't do anything sexually. He did a battery at most. At most, he did a battery, which is the uninvited, unwanted touching. He didn't do a sex crime. You people in England are sick if you can't uphold this conviction.
And you don't mean the sick that means like awesome, right?
No, I don't mean that. I mean the sick the way it used to be before sick became good. So I mean, every time I go to the doctor and I say I'm sick, they never do say what a great, how great that is. But when you go out to the millennials and say, you're all sick, man, they say, oh, wow, thank you.
Charles said he will see you after class to talk about this.
I'm only going by what the article said and then what the judges said, that there could be no other reason. You ain't fit to be a judge if you can't think of any other. I touch people all the time. I'm glad I'm not in England, because, boy, I would be on sex offender registry if I were, because I touch people all the time.
It is so generally used as a, like, when you shake someone's hand, you then reach your arm and maybe touch, like, around their elbow or something. Like, that's often a way that people shake hands, or, you know, you pat somebody on the back, like, and God forbid you do all the things that they do in football games or other sporting events and they give you a good old good game. So, that would be unwanted sexual touching when someone pats you on the tushy.
So, well, he's facing up to a maximum of 10 years in jail and on the registry.
Jesus. So, that's crazy.
So you people over there are as nutty as we are here.
All right. Then our last article before we hit Scalia is, this one is super fun, because I think this one is, I should ask my handler if I can go attend this event. This is in Covington, Georgia. The Newton County Sheriff's Office and the Department of Community Supervision will host their 13th annual Sex Offender Halloween Shut-In from 6 to 10 p.m. on the 31st. What is incredibly exciting about this is the offenders will hear presentations from guest speakers, which will include the Newton County Sheriff, Alcovy?
They pronounce that Alcovy.
Oh, Alcovy. Anyway, they're a circuit court judge, a speaker from the Newton County District Attorney's Office, Deputy Veronica Williams, and probation and parole officers with the Department of Community Supervision. Upon the end of their the presentations, the people in attendance will have an opportunity to engage in a question and answer session. This sounds very informative, Larry.
I don't have a problem with it.
They're going to gather up, I'm going to guess, something of 100, 200 people and put them somewhere. And what kind of presentations are they going to have? Are they going to try and do cognitive behavioral therapy and say doing these activities is bad? I really struggle to see what the actual point of them having presentations. I think these would be very, very low bar presentations. These are not going to be high end presentations.
Well, I would imagine that Sheriff Ezell Brown would be doing this, particularly since he's up for re-election next year. This is my hometown. He's up for re-election next year. I suspect he's doing this. This is not his first rodeo. He was an underling before he got to be sheriff. And what he's doing is making sure that the citizens of Newton County know that he's doing everything he can to keep them safe. And I suspect he would be rendering a campaign type of speech, saying that, guys, I'm not here to punish y'all. I'm just trying to keep my citizens safe and do my duty. And I want you to know this ain't nothing personal, but we got to concentrate on keeping the community safe. This one special day, and the kids are out, and y'all can hang out here for a few hours and maybe learn something. And he's a very nice guy.
I have no doubt about his intent, but the practicality behind it, that we do know that kids get hit by cars on Halloween and not abducted by any of our persons required to register, whatever Brenda told me it's called, that we should probably have more traffic enforcement, making sure that the areas where the children traffic are much slower driven and safer for the cars to travel with all the kids out.
Well, he would tell you he's doing that. He would tell you that I've got my deputies out doing that, and I'm here, and the judges here, and the probation people here, they wouldn't be doing traffic control. He'd say, I'm doing exactly what you're saying. That's what he would tell you.
Fair enough. All right. Well, then I guess we should just let this go.
It's one of those things where it's only the supervised offenders, which have a diminished expectation of right, of liberty, and it's a very brief period, three or four hours?
This one's four hours from 6 to 10 p.m.
And I would like for some of those people to call in and tell us on the marathon what actually is happening, if their cell phones are confiscated. It would be a good opportunity for us to hear a real-life report of what's going on. But on a constitutional basis, it's going to be difficult to challenge this, because they can say it's a therapeutic community, that we do this once a year, and we try to make it a therapeutic experience for these guys to to learn better behavior. It's one of those things where it's a public policy that may not be a good public policy, but all bad public policies don't magically become unconstitutional.
Right. I'm with you on that. I understand. I just personally feel that this is incredibly misguided, regardless of what the PR stunt is of keeping the citizens safe.
There's his opponent is named Malcolm. And what you should do if you live in Newton County is you should call it Mr. Malcolm's campaign. And you should say, I resent what Sheriff Brown is doing. And if you're elected sheriff, will you stop this ridiculous squandering and waste of resources? What's your position? And find out what candidate Malcolm says.
I think that's a fair approach.
And I suspect the citizens of Newton County, and I know the territory fairly well, I suspect the citizens of Newton County are probably pretty happy that this is being done on Halloween, and those people that are paying their debt to society or being closely monitored so their kids can be out trick-or-treating safely. I suspect that Ezell's getting enormous support from the community for what he's doing. That's why he's been doing it for 13 years.
But based on the Facebook posts of people from the Wichmaduke Sheriff in Butts County, I happened to see some of the posts on Facebook that were made to him. He's like, thanks, Sheriff, for keeping us safe, posting no signs in the offender's front yards. Mm-hmm. Great. Thanks. So the people likely approve of this activity.
Well, if we have any listeners in Newton County, let us know if this candidate Malcolm is related to the former sheriff named Gerald Malcolm from back in my era.
All historical.
Well, that tends to run in the family. So I asked when I was there a couple of weeks ago, I asked a couple of folks, and they had forgotten Gerald Malcolm, so nobody knew if he was related or not. But I'm curious, in a county of 100,000, Malcolm is not a real, real common last name. So it could be that they're related. But no one knew of the folks I asked if it was a relationship. They said, well, maybe he is. So I'm curious if it's his offspring in any way that's decided they want to be sheriff.
Are you ready to cover Mr. Scalia?
That's your assignment in Newton County. Figure out if Malcolm is related to the former sheriff.
Very good. All right. You ready for Scalia?
I am ready for Scalia. The purpose of this is to Scalia gets bashed more often than I give him credit for good. But I do try to give him credit for good from time to time. And one of the best things he did was he's been a strong supporter of the Confrontation Clause, and he's a big opponent of the evolving standards of the Constitution, the evolving standards of decency. And this clip explains a little bit of why he doesn't believe much in the evolving standards of decency. So this is intended to be fair to him, because this is not intended to be a bashed Scalia. This is an intent to show how that doctrine, if it's applied consistently, that the outcomes that you would get would not be what you would want in most instances. In the case of confrontation, it's exactly what I wanted on the defense side. That's exactly what we would want would be where Scalia was. But you don't get what you want out of Scalia most of the time. But this is just intended to be fair to show how he comes up to his reasoning.
Very good. Well, here we go.
Where is that one-way street, Nadine? Where does it say the only way the Constitution, the Bill of Rights can evolve is in the direction of more freedom? It doesn't say that anywhere. Will find that it has evolved in both directions.
Due process of law, equal protection of laws, is not a ratification for cutting back on fundamental rights, for cutting back on equality.
If it is to mean whatever the current society wants it to mean, sometimes it'll give you more liberties, sometimes it will take away liberties. Another area where I'm sure I came out the way your members would like was with respect to the Confrontation Clause of the Bill of Rights, which a Supreme Court that believed in an evolving Constitution had essentially gutted. The Confrontation Clause guarantees to all criminal defendants the right to be confronted with the witnesses against them, which means the witness has to appear in open court and make his accusation in open court and be cross-examined. The court had said all that really means is that any hearsay evidence, that is evidence that isn't personally brought before the court, but somebody comes in and says, oh, he told me so. Mm-hmm. Any hearsay evidence must bear indicia of reliability. Well, that's not what the Confrontation Clause said. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to say, two terms ago, we went back to to the original meaning, which had been gutted 20 years earlier. We overruled that earlier case and said, no, the confrontation clause means what it says. You have the right to be confronted with the witnesses against you. So there, I mean, but my point is, you know, if you fall in love with an evolving constitution, do not think that it's going to evolve in just one direction. It's going to evolve in both directions.
It does. I think the assumption would be that if it evolves, it's only going to evolve for the better. But that is definitely not what it would do. It would evolve willy-nilly in both directions.
That's his concern. And he cited a concrete example where the confrontation clause had evolved in a not so positive direction, to where confrontation had gone by the wayside, and then thanks to our state, the case of Bull Cumming, I believe is what he's talking about, where the alcohol case of the evaluation by the lab technician. The lab technician was, they were just simply submitting a report, and the person was coming in saying, this is what the lab technician observed and what they found, and Scalia said, nope, that's not good enough. That person has to be cross-examined on their credentials and how they did their testing, and the report's not good enough. You can't cross-examine a report, and I think that's the case he was probably referring to. But there's no guarantee that the evolving standards of decency. What makes you think that society can only get better and evolve in a positive direction? That's his point. That's a very valid point.
It was kind of funny at the beginning. He, in watching the video, and you can kind of hear it, he gets visibly disturbed with her pushback on the evolvement thing. And he starts like,
well, so apologize for it. It wasn't the best quality, but I could not find
that
clip. No,
that's for sure.
I could not find that clip anyplace else. And I've been looking for it for a while. So we went with what we found, but
it was definitely highly, 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 highly compressed. And it was a fairly old, I think it's from 2006 is when that clip came out. But tell me from your much more evolved point of view on how all of this works, how do you square the circle of the quote unquote, like evolving standards of decency with what the Constitution is like protecting against? I guess that's, I don't know if I can sharpen that any more than that.
I don't know the answer of how you do that, because it's either one philosophy or the other. You believe that it's the court's job to represent society's evolved thinking by judicial interpretation, or you take the Scalia position that it's society's job to communicate those evolved standards through their legislative process, through the people's governing process. And Scalia doesn't believe it's his job to do that. His job is he says society's free to evolve all it wants to, as long as it doesn't go beneath the floor of what the Constitution guarantees. You can evolve.
Is that
you can provide.
My question is going to be: is that the floor, as you put it, the bottom level of what our society should be?
Well, that's Scalia's. He believes that the Constitution provides a protection at the bottom of what you can't go beneath. There are people who believe that the Constitution evolves as society evolves to provide greater protection. Scalia says there's nothing there about protection for people with disabilities. There's nothing in the Constitution about gay right to same-sex marriage. There's all this. This is some kind of evolved invention. And you're free to do that through the legislative process. You're free to bestow greater rights than the Constitution provides. But the floor is the Constitution, and I will protect the floor, but I won't invent rights that are not there. And that's society's job to invent additional rights. Certainly, we've played multiple clips about him about the death penalty. He doesn't believe the Constitution prescribes any prohibition against the death penalty, but he says you're free as a society to pass all the laws you want to that prohibit the death penalty. If you've evolved and you don't think the death penalty is a good thing to do, then simply pass a law that says there'll be no more death penalty. Many states have done that.
And on a larger scale than that, we could make a constitutional amendment to say that that is now the new bottom bar, and capital punishment is, you know, 2/3 go through all the states, all that other crap that goes with it. But we could make it so that the 28th Amendment, I guess, would be is no more whatchamadookie, no more capital punishment.
We could do that. But that's Scalia's his solution is simply that I will protect the minimum, that the Constitution. I will protect what the Constitution meant at the time. And if you people in today's society believe the Constitution provides more, than either amend the Constitution or pass a statute and provide additional benefits. That's not our job wearing a black robe to decide. And that's what the Connecticut Supreme Court just said. Gee, if you want 14-year-olds to be protected, then you need to say that. All 14-year-olds are protected from adult penalties. You didn't say that. You said all 14-year-olds except for this list of offenses. He was on that list of offenses. If you had wanted it to be all offenses, you should have said that.
I still struggle with how do you have a not evolving set a standard of decency, and then also have the ability to amend the Constitution?
There's
it
no
seems
conflict.
To be exactly that.
There's no conflict at all. That's exactly how you evolve the Constitution, is through the processes that we have.
But the idea then is we are supposed to interpret it as it was written back 240 years ago. So what was considered cruel and unusual punishment then is not what we probably would consider it today. But we have to read it as if we were wearing a little white powdered wigs. And how are you supposed to change it if that's not what the level of constitutionality means then versus now?
Well, then you do what Scalia said. You pass a law in the Georgia General Assembly saying that this state has repealed capital punishment. If your standards of decency have evolved to that level that you don't believe it is reflective of societal values, then you pass a law repealing the death penalty. That's all you have to do. That's reflective of your evolving standards of decency.
But then someone challenges it something of like same-sex marriage, where they, you know, stretched the definition of, I guess it's the 14th Amendment, I think, the equal protection stuff, that then becomes the new standard. But the Supreme Court, thinking of things that went white powdered wigs, they say, no, that's not how that worked then. So we don't use that rule now.
Well, if there had been 9 Scalias on the Supreme Court, the same-sex marriage being interpreted to be a constitutional right would not have come down that way. Because he would not have evolved in a right in the Constitution that wasn't there. He would have forced you to go through the legislative process to procure that right.
I do get the legislative process. I can't see how to get around not having some evolution in the standards. Even, you know, we talk about the Second Amendment all the time. They didn't have anything related to an AK-47 or an M-16 back then. They couldn't probably even have conceived of the notion of having some sort of rapid-fire, highly accurate weapon. They were dealing with muskets with balls that didn't have rifled barrels. Okay, so we should judge everything based on that?
Well, there again, there's a solution. All you have to do is pass a law that prohibits the type of weapons you don't want people to possess. And Scalia himself had said the Second Amendment is not absolute. There would be weapons that would be unconstitutional, that people would not have a constitutional right to own. He doesn't know
what
they are
bazookas.
Because he doesn't know what they are, but it's not an absolute right to possess any type of weapon. But you do have the right under Heller, the individual has an individual right to possess firearms. We just don't know to what extent. The National Rifle Association says any and all firearms, if it'll discharge a projectile, practically anything's okay with NRA. So they don't want any encroachment because they see it as a slippery slope, that once you go out and get this, then you're coming for the next. That you people who want to take our guns away, you'll never be happy until all guns are gone. So
right.
they just fight everything.
Yeah. That's not necessarily an unfair point to take.
Well,
I
worry about slippery slopes, so I can understand how
yes.
they come up with that. But the solution is, if your standards of decency have evolved, that you don't want people having AK-47s, pass a law. We did that back in the Clinton administration, and it sunset after 10 years, but we had the assault weapons ban. We can do that.
Right. All right. I think we are very long, and we should shut this thing down, Larry.
Well, how do people support the podcast? And in fact, I received a comment from someone that said that when we send out our podcast, the written stuff, that there's no way to follow how we support. I said, I thought we had that in the notes, how to go to.
It's in the show notes. People would find it on the website, but it doesn't. When the notice goes out that the podcast was released, it's just an email message saying, hey, there was a post. It doesn't give a whole big elaborate response to it all. So from there, they could then go to the website and find it all.
But yeah, how do we grow this thing? We have not hit that 100 mark. We have to hit by the end of the year, or else we're closing down.
So is that the formal declaration that if we don't hit 100 patrons by the end of the year, so we have like less than 12 weeks, we have less than a quarter, we have what, like 11 weeks to get there? So we have to get another, we have to get a good number. You can find it if you go to patreon.com/registrymatters. That is how you support the podcast. $1 a month gets you all of the extras and goodies that we are going to be putting forth after we finish up episode 100.
So, and then what else can they do? What if they want to talk to you?
Oh, to me, they should dial my phone number, and that is, never mind, don't dial that. But the podcast phone number is 747-227-4477. I will say it again to slow it down. Someone complained once about me saying it so fast. 747-227-4477.
And what if they want to send you a message?
They could send a message. You should hop on over to Discord and talk to me and send me a message. Or you could send an email to registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
And then the bestest of all bestest would be the patreon.com/registrymatters.
That is correct.
Become a financial supporter at $1 all the way up to, I don't think there's a limit. I put in $35,000 the other day and it didn't tell me. Some of those things, you put in a certain number of digits, it won't let you go beyond that.
I'm sure there is a limit, Larry, but you haven't found it yet.
Yeah, well,
try
I
again.
I put in $35,000 just to see if it would go, and it didn't have any problem with that.
Very good. That leads us back to the gross versus net thing.
Well, I don't think anybody's going to take us up on either of those.
Probably not. So sad. But that's all I got, Larry, and I so very much appreciate you, and I hope I can have you back again in the next coming weeks. And otherwise, I hope you have a great weekend, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Andy, and good night, everybody.
Take care. Bye.